The great irony of this scenario, Steve, is that you got kind of what you wanted. You planned to get flight following, even though it was optional, in order to get traffic advisories and in order to better navigate the busy airspace you knew you were going into. And then right from the get-go, it's like, wait, hey, that's not what I want. I wanted to be able to climb. We'll get into a bunch of how this might play out and the different choices, but I actually want to back up a little bit here to begin with my first question to you. If you knew at the beginning that this potentially could happen, how would you have avoided it the first time? We know how you're planning to get out of it. You're going to slow down and wait. But rolling the Wayback Machine here, would you have not opted in? Would you have planned a different route? Would you have tried to negotiate something before takeoff while you were still on the ground with the canopy open, maybe? Now that you know that this could happen, what would you do?
I think we're in the situation of no good deed goes unpunished, which is kind of the point of the scenario, and totally understand that. I don't know that there's much you could do. I mean, flying this close to busy airport that is spitting jets out and frankly catching jets, I don't know that there, I mean, what you would have ideally done is left earlier in the morning. Again, as long as we're going to deal with 2020 hindsight, understanding that, you know, avoiding the time of the day when you're going to get that turbulence is likely a much better idea. It is possible that you could reach out to the approach controllers on the ground and get an idea of what kind of traffic might be expected. You're not the only light aircraft that flies through potentially turbulent conditions, and they probably have worked people like you on multiple prior occasions. And if you can get a hold of the controller either on the ground or right after you launch and sort of, you know, hey, not looking for TIRSA yet, but what am I looking at if I get TIRSA services? But again, the moment you have that conversation, if you don't buy into the TIRSA, you're still having that conversation and you're effectively threatening the poor controller with, you know, look, you can either give me what I want, or I'm just going to be an uncontrolled blob that is polluting your airspace. So try to be the good Joe or Josephine, have the conversation ahead of time to the extent that that's practicable.
You know, I like that idea of talking to the controller before you actually ask for services. I think that's kind of interesting. Kevin, one, I'm curious what you think of that. And two, I'm curious what your 1/4 actually means here. So we'll start with that. Can you tell me your 1/4? What does that actually mean?
Well, I like the idea of terminating service and doing what I want, because for me, that's kind of the heart of VFR flying, is I get to do what I want, where I want, within certain safety and legal limitations. So yeah, I like the idea of terminating. But for me, a big qualifier there is I'm not going to terminate in a way where I'm flipping ATC the bird and saying, screw you, I don't like your control instruction, I'm doing what I want, goodbye. I would rather have it where, and just to back up a little bit, ATC in a TIRSA for participating aircraft has to provide separation. So this is a higher level of service than just general VFR flight following wherever else. So because they have to provide separation, you should expect that they're going to give you some restrictions to ensure that separation happens. Now, if all of a sudden you're a non-participating aircraft, well, now they don't have to separate you anymore. So it's possible that by terminating, you're making ATC's job easier because now they don't have to separate you from anybody else. So I would just ask them, hey, is this going to be a problem? Like, if I terminate service and just go on my own squawking 1200, is that going to cause a giant problem for you? And they might say, nope, that's great. Radar service is terminated. You know, see you later. Give a call over banding pass on such and such frequency. And ATC might like it if you did that, because now that's one less airplane that they owe separation to. Now, having said that, the other possibility is that by you doing that, you're going to put them in a spot where they have to give this jet departure panic vectors, or the jet might get a TCAS RA, or any number of things that really everybody wants to avoid. So that's why I would say the 1/4, I'd ask him, hey, like, is this better for both of us if I just terminate? And if so, then I'll terminate. Failing that, I would say, okay, I'll slow down, suck it up, and paint a picture for the controller so the controller knows I'm getting my teeth kicked in by the turbulence here. I want to climb as soon as I can.
And just because this is VFR mastery here, an RA, that would be a resolution advisory, that it's the traffic avoidance system on exactly. The jet, and the jet would have to follow that. The pilots would not have a choice. They'd have to climb or turn or whatever the TCAS told them to do.
Well, exactly. And it's not just that. When a TCAS RA happens, the pilot that is experiencing that is required to report that to ATC. And then the controller then has to turn around and tell their supervisor that they're having a TCAS RA. The supervisor has to log it and might ask the controller what caused that TCAS RA to happen. And, oh, it was this guy that did this thing. And then it was like, well, hang on. All right, well, maybe this guy needs to talk to FISDO about this. And I don't want to have a conversation with FISDO. As a pilot, I have zero interest in defending something I did to FISDO. I would rather avoid that conversation entirely.
So you're basically, Kevin, you're asking for what you want. You have an insider information that, hey, maybe this will actually free things up for the controller. But if the controller is like, yeah, I can't let you go, or, you know, squawk 1200, but maintain 3000 for now, you know, whatever and stay on my frequency, whatever it happens to be, you're going to play along with that. Paul, you're just going with one, which Steve said was a jerk move. So what do you think about that? You're just going to cancel. You're in the TRSA. You've opted in, and now you are going to cancel and be like, bye, and keep climbing. Why is that?
Well, I'm being a jerk on behalf of my passengers. And I guess the point I'm making here is acting on pilot and command authority, and not laboring or being beholden to the notion that we're up there flying around to provide controllers a job, and that we have to always bend to the voice of authority. In certain circumstances, we do. But in this case, I view it as safety of flight. I've got two kids and probably three passengers plus myself who, it's just not unpleasant. They could get sick, and this becomes a distraction. And that is safety of flight to me. It might not rise to the level of an emergency, but I do have this option because TRSA service is optional. And if we thought in this airspace that it needed Class C for a higher level of separation, or Class B, that's what it would have, but it doesn't have that. So Hank, I guess I would follow Kevin's example and say, look, I'll take a heading here, but I really got to climb to get out of this turbulence for my passengers. Mm-hmm. And if that's going to be a problem, then maybe I'll stick with it. But otherwise, I would exercise my pilot in command authority. We have this option. I don't think we should get wrapped around the axle on it being some kind of potential violation.
So, Paul, what would you do if the controller said no? The controller said, no, I need you to stay with me for a moment, and then I can let you cancel. Would you raise the bar again and be like, I'm canceling and I'm using PIC authority to do it? Or would you then like, okay, fine, but like you said, negotiate, I have to have a heading so that I can climb. If I stay with you, I can't stay at 3000. What would be your strategy?
Yeah, I'd do the negotiation. Hey, well, how long? Mm-hmm. And if it's 2 minutes, well, that's one thing. But if he's going to keep me down there for 10 or 15 miles, which is not uncommon, then I'm going to have an issue. And I'd ask him for a heading first. And if that wasn't possible, yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stick it and climb, because I really want to get these passengers out of this turbulence. And, you know, we should say here, as most people who live out in that area know, in the desert Southwest, they don't really fly at this time of day because it's just miserable. And going through Banning Pass, it's not necessarily going to get worse. It'll get cooler a little, but it still could be pretty bumpy. And so in a sense, this is a extremist of the pilot's own making, but he stuck with it and now has to deal with it.
Right. And that, and stuck with it with the rental schedule, which, you know, a lot of us would be beholden to. First time you could get the plane, it was not a bad plan necessarily to get up high right away, but this is what's standing in the way. You mentioned time, and Tom, you were choosing option two, which, you know, Steve had pointed out in his response, might actually take longer than just waiting if it's one jet that's leaving. So what was your thinking behind two? Is it part of what Paul was saying, like, this is a whole bunch of jets, or it's just you want to have the control, or, hey, this is the best choice? What was it that appealed to you there?
Yeah, it was the idea that they could hold me down for a long time because there could be multiple departures. And really what I'm doing is I'm declaring my heading. I haven't been giving a heading by the controller, so I'm going to declare to the controller that I'm going to turn north and heading north. And when I get past that shelf, I'm going to go ahead and cancel at that point, cancel advisories at that point, and climb up unless he can continue to provide me service. The reason I want to stick with him for a little bit longer and I'm willing to sort of tough it out until I get past that shelf is I'm waiting to hear what that jet's doing. He's probably going to go, you know, pretty much runway heading out of the area, but it's also possible he's going to turn more to the north, could become a factor. And by me staying with ATC for a few minutes longer, I'm going to know what direction he's going and will be, I think, better informed about what ATC might ask of me if they suddenly are not happy with me declaring that I'm turning north.
Right. And, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but all the jets that are departing from Palm Springs pretty much are turning towards the Palm Springs VOR or the thermal VOR, which is the, you know, where you're going or where you just came from, essentially, in terms of what's going on there. I still want to go to Wally and to Dave. We'll start with you, Wally. You're a choice four. You're going to slow down and wait it out. What's the thinking?
Well, first of all, I'm going to slow down because that's going to make the bumps a little smoother for my passengers, hopefully. My goal is not to go cross country at this point, not to make miles. My goal is to delay a few minutes until I can get that clearance up to a higher altitude. So that's why I chose the slowdown part. I think our pilot should not have been surprised at the fact that he got held down here because he's flown out of this airport at least 16 hours in his Diamond time. And he's had some experience in this area, and I'm sure this is a pretty common occurrence at that coming out of that airport heading for Banning Pass. I'm guessing that you're going to be snagged up with traffic going in and out of Palm Springs pretty regular. So I think you should stay with flight following because it's a heck of a busy area down there. And you you know, once you've given it away, now you've got to go up through that pass and head into that Los Angeles complicated airspace up there sort of on your own. And I'd just rather stay with them and have the help.
Did you have anything you wanted to add to that, Dave? You know, slow down, just wait it out.
Yeah, I've got something to add. It's like, to me, you know, Steve's legalistic interpretations of this just hurt my head. It's like, and it was a good idea. But it's like, hey, if that's what two CFIs are going to talk about at the bar, remind me not to go to the bar with other CFIs because that's just excruciating. But basically, this is a straight character test. I applaud this pilot for doing this flight in the safest way he knows, which is getting, you know, the ATC service. And it's like, and I'm sympathetic toward him because having flown a DA-40, it's a really lightly wing-loaded airplane with a really hard seat. And when you're getting knocked around in turbulence, it's super unpleasant. I totally get that part. But it's like the pilot asks for ATC service. He gets it. If he doesn't like the answer, it's just like a kid asking to borrow the car and says, hey, can I borrow the car, mom? And mom says no, and then goes to dad. You know, it's like, forget that stuff. Just be a stand-up person. You're getting the benefit of the service. You asked for it. You're getting the benefit of the added separation. You got to accept the downside. Quit your whimpering and just stick with the control. Suffer in silence and look at it as a little character building exercise. And if your kids are uncomfortable, it's like, hey, you're just, you know, you're modeling good behavior, suffer in silence and stick it 3,000 feet till you're told otherwise.
I feel like you just gave us the dad answer. Like, we went to dad and dad said, it's character building. Tough it out there, man. Tough it out. I want to go back to you, Kevin, for a second about something in here about canceling. And I don't know if it's different between a Tirsa and a Class Charlie here, so I'd love you to clarify that as well. But if this pilot cancels flight following, does the controller have to let the pilot go? Is that like, I have to let you squawk 1200 and leave the frequency? Or can the controller, once the pilot's opted in, keep the pilot under positive control? And does it matter, Tirsa to Class Charlie, once the service started?
If you look in the 0.65, the way that it is, the Tirsa separation rules are described, it's the exact same wording for the Tirsa as a Class Charlie and the Charlie outer area, as far as separation and that kind of thing goes. Mm-hmm. Now, is the controller allowed to, by the rules, tell you, no, you can't terminate service, you got to stay with me? I don't think they could do that, but I will tell you, I have seen controllers do that. Do I think it's okay? No, I don't think it's okay. But it doesn't mean the controllers don't do it.
So, you know, honest answer there, which I really appreciate. Let me ask you another one for an honest answer. If the pilot pulls a Bertarelli here and says, you know what, you're not going to let me climb, you're not going to give me a turn, pilot cancels, how far does this pilot have to go before contacting SoCal Approach again? Before they're like, oh, you again. You didn't want services before. We might be too busy now. Is it? Is there any kind of like a grudge thing that you might have to worry about there or no?
I think it's going to be very situational. Like you, mm-hmm. It could be that the controller working the next sector overheard the controller that's working you cap you at 3. Mm-hmm. And maybe the controller working the next sector is looking at the one that gave you the restriction saying, man, what a jerk. Why did he restrict him to 3? He didn't have to do that. He could have done, you know, these 3 other things to get the guy climbing on course. That's, wow, that sucks. And then maybe you call that other controller. He's like, yeah, I got you. Sorry about that other guy. Or it could be like what you're talking about, where now you've got the scarlet letter, and now they're just going to assume that you're a knucklehead and whatever. But no, I wouldn't stress about that too much, because it's so situational in ways that as a pilot flying through the airspace, I don't think you'd be able to predict that. So I wouldn't worry about that at all.
I want to zoom back out a little bit to kind of the bigger picture of a scenario like this, which is ATC instructions and flying under VFR, because we do get questions about this regularly, or people complaining that they were coming into busy airspace, maybe like the other side of this trip, where they were restricted to an altitude, don't descend. And by the time they were finally released to descend, you know, they were way high for the airport that they were going into. And just a quick show of hands around the table, like how many people have found themselves in that situation? Because I feel like, yeah, hand, yeah, every single hand is up. And that is kind of the bigger picture here of this amorphous zone where you're getting services, but you are VFR. What are people's strategies around that, Paul?
Well, first we have to deal with Hirschman's child abuse here, suggesting that having the kids throw up in the back seat is somehow character building.
It's not?
No, no, it isn't. There's no way.
What about cleaning up afterwards? I think, is that character building?
Well, having cleaned my share of vomit out of the radio knobs, it's not character building. I can assure you we've all done it. But as far as ATC services, you don't have to sit there and bear it. Get the best deal you can. Negotiate with the controller, get the heading or the altitude or whatever it is that you need, and try to be as flexible as you can. But there is no percentage, in my view, and no advantage in just sitting there taking it just to prove a point. Make it work for you.
There's no advantage to you. There may be an advantage to the system. And to me, it's like, if you're out VFR by yourself, hey, do what's best for you within the confines of the, you know, the normal limitations. But once you ask for ATC services and you receive them, now your obligation is to the benefit of the entire system in which you're taking part. So it's like,
yeah, but you have an obligation to get the best deal that works for you, and there's no harm in asking. It's like asking for direct.
Don't be a selfish jerk. Just be part of the system. You're obligated.
It's not being a selfish jerk. You're asking for a better deal.
Okay.
Just how it works.
So let me go to the controller who's sitting at the table here. We made sure we had Kevin. Which do you, if you knew, if you could like see what's going on inside all these different airplane cabins, do you want the pilot who is, I'm not going to use the word pestering, but aggressively asking for what they need and reminding you again and again, or the pilot who is suffering in silence until you're like, oh yeah, by the way, you can climb now. Which would you rather somebody err towards, asking too much or asking too little?
I would much rather the pilot speak up and say what it is that they need. Absolutely. Because it could legit be, I didn't know that you had an altitude restriction. And I've had that happen before as a controller, where a prior controller issued an altitude restriction. And then I get somebody say, hey, can I descend? It's like, well, yeah, if you want to land, that's probably a good idea. Well, and then they come back and say, well, I was restricted. Like, oh, not by me. Sorry, I wasn't aware that you were restricted. Absolutely. Like, I recommend you descend. And by the way, maybe you want to make a 360 or something like that because you're too damn high to make a normal descent to where you're trying to go.
Tom, you had something earlier. Tom.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that really at the end of the day, it's all about communication. And if, as Kevin said, if you have a problem, let's speak up and let the controller know, because he's busy with other things. And so it's like, I'm hounding him. It happens lots of times coming into Frederick. You're coming in way too high, particularly from the west. And so I'm going to start hounding them early on. I've probably got my VNAV all set up and I know when I want to descend because I've been planning. And when I'm starting to approach that top of descent point, I'm calling ATC if I get the sense they're not going to be there for me, and give them a clue that I want to start down. And then if they don't let me start down because they've got traffic or other situations, then I'm starting to plan, okay, I'm going to have a steep descent here. What do I need to do to change my normal arrival plan to be prepared for, you know, a steep descent? Am I putting in approach flaps? Am I just slowing down? What about engine cooling? Because am I going to have to yank the power back to get this descent in, or gear down, whatever? So I'm pulling the power back to start the engine, cooling the engine off now. And so it's really all about communication and planning, depending on how it's all playing out.
You know, but pilots often have trouble, especially newer pilots, with the sort of challenging the authoritative voice of ATC. And I'm thinking, Wally, you've probably seen this again and again, particularly maybe on instrument check rides and things like that, where someone is really nervous and you're looking over their shoulder. What have you seen for the kinds of pilots who handle it well or not, or even just things that you've learned to tell people to help them get over the ATC mic fright, really? Asking for things from ATC.
Well, yeah, I think somebody mentioned earlier that that ATC can be very intimidating, particularly for a new pilot. You know, we have to, as others have said, we have to remind them who the pilot in command is and that they're there to help us. And but they need to know what we want. If we don't tell them, they can't guess it. So, you know, one of the things I suggest for new pilots to get, most everybody has a handheld radio nowadays, and I tell them to go sit in the parking lot at the nearby international airport and listen to the corporate pilots and the airline pilots and the GA pilots, and learn about the good stuff and the bad stuff, and learn how different people handle it. They can hear an awful lot of exchanges going on there by listening to either departure, approach, or clearance. Also tell them, tune in clearance delivery and practice copying these other guys' clearances, as if you're an IFR applicant. So there's a lot they can do to sort of get over that. Of course, visiting the ATC facilities is an awesome experience because they actually realize there are people in there that look just like they do, not monsters. So,
you know, I want to go to you, Steve, for a moment, because you obviously have your aviation lawyer hat on that was making Dave's head hurt. But what people may not realize is you're also an airshow air boss, do training with the Tuskegee Foundation, if I have that right, and do formation flying as well. So you're dealing with really unusual requests at times and coordinating with ATC around Detroit, where you are, where you've got air shows. Do you have anything that experience has taught you about working with ATC? Because you're sometimes asking for some pretty unusual things in this other role.
I've got a
liaison with the TRACON at for a Detroit approach. Matter of fact, I'm required to because I get a TFR for my people, so we don't have some banner tower flying into the area of operations for the air show. It's and that's probably why I gave the answer about, you know, hey, what could you do in 2020 hindsight? It's hard to get a hold of the facility on a landline, although you can do that if you can. You know, the interaction between Dave and Paul and, of course, me, lawyer hurting people's heads, it made me really think about it. Maybe asking a question of the controller prior to the handoff, hey, what's this other guy or gal going to expect? The more you can do to prearrange or to tell the controller what you have in mind and to get that understanding together as quickly as possible and use storytelling. I am trying to do this. I've got really unhappy young passengers and we're getting our butts kicked and things like that. The more you can do storytelling with the controller to tell them what you need, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, I like your point about the kids screaming in the back when I used to fly a lot of IFR with young kids on board. I taught my kids early on to how to ask for direct. And I got direct clearances way more often when the 7-year-old keyed up the mic and said it with exactly the right phraseology than when I did it. So yeah, you can use that kind of leverage in there. You talked about plans and storytelling. I want to go back to you, Kevin. This pilot had a plan to go to the Palm Springs VOR and then over to Banning Pass, which from a VFR point of view, sure, makes perfect sense. It's easy. It's on the route. But we know that the Palm Springs VOR, Palm Springs and Thermal, is where all the IFR traffic goes to as part of the departure procedure. Is that something that you think VFR pilots should take into account? Or is that just from a controller's perspective, you know what, ATC will deal with that. Don't worry about it. Go where you want to go and we'll work with you. Or is that something that pilots, VFR only pilots, should really try and avoid, think about?
I don't understand why a pilot would choose to navigate over a VOR for the sport of it. In general, though, if you have a concern about avoiding traffic that's coming in or out of an airport, the easiest way to avoid that is to fly over, directly over the airport that you're worried about traffic, because any arrivals and departures aren't going to be over the airport a few thousand feet above it. They're going to be taking off or landing when they're over the airport.
Yeah, that makes absolutely a lot of sense. Let me stay with you for a second. When this pilot checked in, the pilot said that they were heading for Banning Pass and climbing to 8,500. Was there a you're nodding your head. Was there really a miscommunication right there? Because this plane is pointed towards Palm Springs VOR. Pilot said Banning Pass, which actually would be right over the airport from where they are right now. Was that potentially another place where this pilot could have made things easier by providing more information? You don't want to check in with, you know, your date of birth and your you know, astrological sign and everything like that. But a little bit more information as to what their plan was?
Well, it could be that the reason the controller gave the restriction was like, okay, you said you're going to Banning Pass. I believe you'll eventually get there, but you're taking the scenic route. I don't know how that's going to shake out. So at or below 3 for now, and that'll keep you out of the way, and you can do whatever VFR stuff you're trying to do.
Right. And then if you had been like Paul there, the pilot had said, well, I just need to climb higher. I can take any direction. Well, if you start going for Banning Pass right now, then yeah. And Kevin's nodding there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yep. Then you can go. And that might have been the issue. So
potentially.
Being a little bit more concise there. There's a lot more that we could go with this scenario, but there is one thing I did want to look at. Wally, you brought up a great point that, and I think you did too, Paul, that this is not the time of day to fly in the Southwest in the summertime. It's going to be hot. It's going to be bumpy. And Dave said, you know, the DA-40 is kind of the wrong plane for that. It's a greenhouse and it's lightly wing loaded. It's entirely possible, I would think, that this pilot maybe never had this experience before. They didn't realize how bumpy it would be because they always did fly early in the morning or late in the evening, right? And that is that it came as a surprise, actually, as to how bad it really can be in this area. So I just want to put that out there that, you know, for anyone who's like, gosh, this pilot never should have done that, that, you know, this is kind of a new situation potentially to this pilot that they've never dealt with. Look like you want to say something there, Wally.
Okay. I think it certainly turned out to be a learning experience. If he didn't know before, it turned out to be a learning experience for him. Unfortunately, with the kids along learning whatever they're going to learn.
Yeah, hopefully they won't learn that they don't like flying to Broadway shows. Paul, then Kevin.
Yeah, well, this is a question for Kevin. In my experience, particularly on advisories, but also IFR, when the handoff happens, it hasn't been well communicated between the two controllers. So one trick that I used to use was taught by someone, but I don't necessarily hear too much anymore, particularly on VFR, when you're handed off, you tell the controller 3,000 feet assigned. And that reminds that controller, who might not otherwise know, that, oh, this guy's being held down for some particular reason that no longer applies. Is that still kind of the case, Kevin? And does that kind of a phraseology make sense?
I think that is absolutely a really good suggestion, is if you're going to check in, especially if you're VFR and you have been given, whether it's a heading or an altitude restriction or anything of the sort, you check in with the next controller. Yes, so you make it very explicitly clear that I still have a restriction from the prior controller. Now, if you're in Bravo airspace, maybe not so much, because if you're in Bravo, it's kind of expected that you're going to be tied down in a specific way. But outside of Bravo, yeah, I think that's a great idea to check in with whatever your restriction is.
Dave?
In Paul's case, it can be 3,000 feet assigned, about to be disregarded.
Stop your whining, Dave.
You know,
just trying to be clear.
Your reputation precedes you all around SoCal, both of you probably. Some scenarios, they just seem like non-scenarios, you know, like here, wait a few minutes, this whole thing will resolve. But the bigger picture is, right when VFR traffic benefits the most from ATC services, busy airspace, is right when the pilot is most likely to get saddled with unpleasant restrictions. Mm-hmm. So the takeaway for me here is you should learn to anticipate that possibility. Many of you have said that, and see what you can do in terms of planning to limit the likelihood of those conflicts happening. But then when it does, you have a responsibility to let the controllers know in plain English what's happening on your side of the mic and what you need to fix it.